Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the regularly scheduled October 1st meeting of the San Luis Coastal School Board. It's always great to see folks in the audience, even if many of them work here. We'll get started. We have all of our members here. Hi, Scott. Are we all in accord on the order of business? We are?
Yes.
Okay. We did not have closed session tonight, one of those few times, so we have nothing to report out. And we will move to student representative report.
Thank you. So things have been high energy at Slow High, and it's only going to get even more exciting next week with our homecoming week. But just to recap, two Fridays ago, we had our first spirit rally, which was highlighted by a choreographed dance routine to Backstreet's Back by five male teachers and Mr. O'Connor. So they were the Backstreet Boys for our rally, and that got the kids very excited. Last week, we also had our first newspaper issue, which I see one's right here. The main headline is Black is the New Brown, in reference to our switching of the deans. So that was highly received, and it's a great issue all around. Also, last week, we had our first student congress meeting, which was refounded last year. Student Congress is a great way for the student body who are not in ASB to have their opinions directly heard by the administration. So Mr. O'Connor was in attendance with a few other administrators, and we pretty much spent an hour just answering questions about everything that the students care about from their own classes, like the new bell schedule. There was coffee served at our school for a couple weeks, and then, you know, they were curious of why it got taken out and all that good stuff. So Student Congress is always really exciting, and it was a good first meeting. We also had a booster bash on Saturday, which is our main athletic fundraiser. Over $70,000 was raised, so you could say it was quite successful. This week, on Friday, we are having our second Fresh Friday, which is a new thing ASB is doing. It's a very casual dance after any of the games. So this one, we're going to do line dancing again, because line dancing was really highly received. It was a lot of fun. So we're going to do that again this week on Friday. And it's totally free. Anybody can come after the game and just learn to line dance. And so that's exciting. Next week, we are having our homecoming week. If anyone's curious, our theme is Land of the Three, Home of the Tigers. And each grade level is respected. Other than that, we have a new website, which is being professionally done. I know I'm really excited for that. Mr. O'Connor's really excited for that. That's like his baby. Because our website, it's all right, but it was developed by a teacher at our school. You know, it was usually upkept by a teacher. Now we're getting professionals to come in and totally revamp it. And I'm excited to see what it looks like. And that is all the news I have from our school. But I would now like to turn all our attention to a senior at Slo High. Her name is Jessie Judge. And Jessie Judge will be representing California at the National FFA Competition for Prepared Public Speaking. So thank you, Jessie.
Amon Bear, a thriving egg producer, has devoted his life to his family-run poultry operation in Lake Park, Minnesota. The farm is comprised of Bear, his three brothers, and their families, who have worked hard for more than a decade to create a legacy in egg production. But unfortunately, small to medium-sized egg producers, like the Bear family, risk being jeopardized by the Egg Products Inspection Acts of 2012, commonly known as EPIA, a joint agreement between the United Egg Producers, or UEP, and the Humane Society of the United States, also known as HSUS. For the first time, agriculturists and HSUS have drafted a federal requirement that will dictate national egg farming protocols and wreak havoc amongst livestock industries in fear of HSUS control. On July 7th, 2011, the UEP and HSUS announced that they had reached an unprecedented agreement to jointly enact federal legislation that would greatly alter production conditions for egg-laying hens. This agreement combined the amendments of the EPIA of 2012, passed in the House as H.R. 3798 and in the Senate as S-3239. Prior to the EPIA agreement, California passed Proposition 2, which requires the elimination of battery cages, thus leading the way for a federally supported bill to regulate all egg production. If enacted, this legislation would prohibit the commercial buying and selling of shell eggs and egg products from hens who are not raised according to the new housing and production requirements. The agreement includes 7 key provisions pertaining to the production of eggs and egg products. The most abrasive provision would require producers to replace conventional cages with new enriched cage systems. Although HSUS claims all proposed cage requirements are based on high levels of scientific research, many egg producers beg to differ. Larger cages may prove sufficient in the warmer temperatures of the South, but they could run up energy costs in the North, where temperatures are much cooler and heated pens are required, thus making it difficult for egg producers to be profitable. Understandably, UEP made the agreement in search of a positive impact on the egg industry for enriched cages. An analyst for the Egg Industry Center at Iowa State University claims medium-sized farms with less than 1 million laying hens will try to expand in response to the legislation, but their business will most likely fail. Producers are not the only ones at risk of losing their livelihoods, as large corporate control of the industry would likely lead to higher prices at any grocery store, thus affecting each and every American consumer. In recognition of difficult economic situations, the agreement allows for 3 exemptions to cage conversion. First, egg farmers who installed new cages between January 1st, 2008 and December 31st, 2011 would have 18 years rather than 15 years to meet the bill's requirements. However, from 2008 to 2011, only 5.7% of the nation's medium-sized egg producers, each having over 75,000 laying hens each, had converted to new enriched cages. Second, if an egg producer had a laying hen flock in production when the bill was enacted, they would be exempt from meeting requirements until the hens were moved out of production. And lastly, small egg farms with less than 3,000 laying hens would be completely exempt from the requirements. Although EPIA has good intentions, we cannot overlook the devastating effects it would impose. Not only would it inflict higher production costs that squeeze poultry producers out of business, but it would also lead to more regulation, not exclusive to the poultry industry, but for other livestock industries as well. The National Pork Producers Council calls this a dangerous first step, and they are gravely concerned that such a one-size-fits-all approach will take away producers' freedom to operate in a way that is best for their animals. Similarly, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association is rightfully concerned with the recent agreement and has chosen to vigorously oppose the bill. The agreement is viewed as a mere stepping stone to more severe future regulations that would impact all livestock sectors. Producers and consumers in production agriculture must take drastic steps to defeat this bill. First, the agriculture industry must acknowledge the mistake made by UEP for making such negotiations with HSUS. Second, suggestions for alternate solutions to sustain safe, marketable industries must be made. With varying weather and economic conditions throughout the country, state-regulated policies would prove best for keeping egg producers in business. To ensure the safest conditions, state policies that work to implement industry-led, science-based production practices must be organized and put in place. For example, the Beef Quality Assurance Program, or BQA, has self-regulated the beef industry for more than 2 decades. State-regulated policies backed by safety assurance programs would ensure, with the potential to decimate sectors of agriculture that have long helped to sustain the economic backbone of our country. Thank you.
Thank you. That was very impressive, and your knowledge of the facts and ability to make a speech like that was astounding. Good luck in the Nationals. I have good feelings about your chances. And you should give that argument to the U.S. Supreme Court when all this comes up for review. Very good. Thank you for sharing that with us. And we'll now move to public comment. Correspondence. Sorry. Thank you, Chris. He's done this before. We received a letter from Dr. Crocker, County Superintendent of Schools, regarding the contract with SEIU. And we received an email from Myla Boyovich-Lavar regarding traffic and other impacts at SLO High, including the Land Use Circulation Element Task Force and the Johnson Avenue Project. Thank you. And we have an email from Becky Jansen regarding bus routes for Los Ranchos. And I believe that's it. Okay. Now we will move on to public comment. Public comment is a period where anyone can comment on any item not on the agenda. We allow 3 minutes per speaker, and unless there's a extenuating circumstances, we typically allow 20 minutes for this portion of public comment. And I believe we have one request from Charlie Perriessa. Always good to hear from him.
Greetings, I'm Charlie Perrias. Welcomes from the steamy school. In my teaching career, I've ridden a whole lot of roller coasters and hung on to a lot of pendula as we try this and try that. And there have been a lot of pros and a lot of cons all the way through the whole voyage. And I think there's a whole lot of pros to what we're trying to do at the middle school, at Los Osos Middle School right now. Including a stunning sixth grade staff and interdepartmental projects, which I'm going to try to represent tonight by an English teacher impersonating a bar graph. So I'm here to voice a couple concerns on the con side regarding our proposed change to our elective program. Sixth to eighth graders really are motivated a ton by choice. They love choice, and they developmentally need choice. And we adults give them practice choosing at home and at school so that when they get to bigger, uglier decisions, they kind of know what they're doing with choice. In school, we traditionally do that through an elective program. You know, there's other choice, but that's the primary deal. When I started back in the dark ages at Los Osos Junior High in 1984, the kids had seven classes on their schedule. They had two electives in seventh grade, two in eighth. And that was approximately 24% of their school day, their middle school career as a choice. Along the line, and now we have sixth grade, and at the moment the sixth graders don't have choice. They may, because we're still developing it. But that gets, during their three-year career, it cuts them down to 5%. So over all those years, we lost German, we lost French, orchestra, journalism, creative writing, guitar, sections of art, sections of shop. We lost the whole shop. We lost home ec sections, and it looks like we're going to lose home ec because those aren't 21st century skills. In the new proposal, the kids will be having less than that. And there's so many pros. Thanks for just a couple seconds. I'm hoping someone at the board level will speak out and say, choice is important to these kids. We also have to ask, if this is what we're doing, how soon before we lose choir and band? Thanks a lot for listening.
Thank you, Charlie. That was very effective, by the way. We'll let the administration figure that out, and we'll go from there. But a business and budget update. Ryan, you going to handle that?
So, yeah, I was fortunate enough last week to attend the School Services Local Control Funding Formula Workshop, and so I put a little guide for each of you at the table there. And some key aspects that I learned from going to that workshop is, one, they're just now starting to kind of come to grips with what this means and the formulas and the impact that it's going to have for schools across the state of California. But one of the coolest things was they kind of went through a timeline. So 1972 was really the last – it's been 40 years since we had a major change in the way schools were funded. So 1972 is when we went to a revenue limit categorical-based funding mechanism. Then we had Prop 13 that was passed in 1978, which basically put a limit on property tax revenues and what, you know, property tax could be raised. And right after that, so which basically affected the revenue side of the house and actually brought the state more, instead of having local control in a lot of the property taxes and the way schools are funded, it actually brought the state more into the role of being part of school funding. Prop 4 was then passed, which basically limited government spending. So lowered revenues and then also stopped kind of a spending limit, which was interesting. And then in 1988, so Prop 98 was supposed to provide kind of a minimum level of what education was supposed to be. And actually what that turned out to be was a maximum level for education funding in the state. 1996, when the state was doing well, brought class size reduction. So kind of another aspect of it. And then into what we've seen recently was a recession in 08, which really took a big hit in terms of revenues and expenditures. And so this new law, AB 97, which brings in this local control funding formula, is supposed to provide a base level of funding for all schools in California. So that's what it's about. There's supplemental grants and concentration grants, which are focused on. They also said the state regulations will come, right? But the more districts can get out in front and do the right thing and do what they're supposed to do, hopefully that will kind of tell the state and tell the government that they don't necessarily need to put needless regulations onto where we're headed. So that said, it's still kind of a tenuous time. Though it seems better for school districts, it's still a tenuous time in the state in that the new base level, the new supplemental grants, concentration grants have been established. And so there is a 8-year kind of ramp-up period to get to those levels of where school districts are supposed to be. So this first year, districts, whatever they currently had as their revenue limit, received an 11.78% increase towards that, basically their LCAP amount or their local control funding formula amount. And so over the next 8-year period, the hope is that the economy will continue to grow, money will be put towards education, and they'll eventually get to that amount. Now, we all know that there's a lot of ifs in that scenario, and whether or not we'll really reach that amount in 8 years, you know, we'll have to see and see where that goes. In terms of San Luis Coastal, we're a basic aid school district, so most of our properties or most of our revenues are from our property tax revenues. And so right now, our difference between what our current LCAP amount or our LCFF amount would be versus what we currently receive in basic aid revenue property taxes, about $19 to $20 million. So it's a huge amount that is still a deficit amount for us in terms of reaching that point. Now, that said, it would be fantastic for us if 8 years from now our LCFF amount was the same as our property tax revenues, because that would mean that all school districts across the state of California would be doing well. That would be a great thing, and wouldn't put us in kind of our precarious situation, always worrying about Diablo Canyon and property taxes and real estate values and those types of things, right? So we'll continue to measure that over the years as things go and look at that, because should that happen, that changes the whole kind of position of us in terms of ADA, attendance, do we develop programs to draw more students into our district? So we'll really have to kind of analyze that each year to see where we're at with our LCFF amount and the impact that will have on our overall revenues as we move forward. So it was really interesting to go through that. Another interesting dynamic that came out of it was the fact that out of the since 2000, and I shared this in Friday notes, there's been six districts that have become insolvent during those times. And you would think that those would be the district that had really been suffering budget-wise prior to that happening. And in actuality, all of those except for one had double-digit increases in their overall revenues. But what happened was they bargained for too much, and when the economy fell quickly, they fell as well. So it was an interesting dynamic to actually see, because you would think it would be quite the opposite. The district would have been suffering, and then they would have dropped into that realm. So that was a really interesting dynamic. And so it's an interesting dynamic, you know, in terms of those. They did say some of the issues and problem areas are Head Start funding. There's some issues with possibly with free and reduced lunch, federal subsidies for that in the future. They have enough money now for a month or so to kind of get by with the amounts that they have. But those would be things that, should it continue on for a while, would be an issue. And then I believe that actually the State Department and CDE, some of their funds that they receive, are going to be impacted by this federal shutdown and could have an impact on the Department of Education, more so than possibly us at a local school district. So those are some of the key things happening right now with the budget.
Just to clarify a couple of points. So at present, we are not really going to be beneficiaries of the LCFF, the local control funding formula, in the sense that the additional monies won't necessarily come our way because we are adequately funded by whatever standard they choose. But we may down the road move to the LCFF.
It's a possibility.
It's a possibility.
Right? Yeah, and so that would, again, there's all the different things that are determinants in that. Are our real estate values, are our property taxes going to go down? I mean, our revenues could go down, right? Which could mean that the LCFF amount could be more similar to or where we need to head. But currently, that's something that's not... it would be years, I believe, before we would kind of meet that balance point with that. Now, they did hold our categorical levels to the 12-13 amount. So out of this process, that is a positive thing for us, because there was the concern that they could take all of our categorical funds. So they did hold us to that 12-13 amount last year. And so that, you know, in some ways, that is a positive. We are going to receive the proposition funds from last November's election, the $200 a student. So those are key things as well.
And one more, maybe it's an observation more than a question. Although we're not necessarily being affected now by the government shutdown, we have or will be affected by the sequester, at least in those programs that are funded by the federal government.
Yes. Okay. Our categoricals are less this year based on those federal amounts.
What about what percentage of our overall budget is funded through federal programs or dollars? Don't mean to put you on the spot.
I couldn't tell you.
It used to run around 8%.
I'll find out for you, but I couldn't tell you off the top of my head.
Okay. I was just curious. I didn't grok all of this. I was trying. But some of this seems awfully familiar. It's just the names have changed. But we're still fighting this. Are our property taxes more than... Yeah. But it sounds like that nothing bad is going to happen to us in the short term, meaning the next 2 to 5 years.
Yeah. I would assume that if the LCFF amount goes up and the state economy is doing well, that our property tax revenues on our own side would also increase at the same time.
Yeah.
The passage of Assembly Bill 484, the Bonilla bill that passed early last week, it's on the governor's desk. We expect Governor Brown to sign it. He has 30 days or now maybe 20 days to do so, and it's expected that will happen. It passed by about a 3-to-1 margin in both houses of the legislature, but that doesn't mean it's not without controversy, because it does eliminate virtually all of the state testing that would be happening in the state this year. And the bill is basically saying to the state of California, look, you've changed your standards. We've adopted the Common Core state standards, and so no longer will we expect schools to measure students, schools, districts with a test that is not aligned to those standards. And so it's a pretty bold initiative. What it appears as if, and if you read the bill, it indicates that, for one thing, we will be taking field tests of the new version of the Smarter Balance Assessment Consortium test. These will be field tests only, meaning that even if we were to get results, and we don't expect to get results, that they would be unable to be used for any purpose whatsoever, not able to be published, not used for any purpose. So it gives us the opportunity to try out these tests in a low-stake environment, to see how our technology works, to make sure that we can handle all of our students being tested. These tests are expected to be given in the third through eighth grade level and grade 11 inclusive, which is what the new assessment protocol will be. Second grade will not be part of it. Ninth and tenth grade will not be part of state testing. There may be some field tests next year in ninth or tenth grade, but eventually it will only be 11th grade is the only place that will be assessed in high school. The only CST tests that will remain, at least for the short term, are in science. Those will be given in grades 5, 8, and 10. There will be no API scores published either next year or the year after, according to the legislation. So we will have no comparative data from a state level to report either at the end of this year or at the end of the following year. For us, I think it's the right. It seems like the right course. We're moving on with the Common Core standards, and so to test on something that we're no longer teaching to, it makes perfect sense. One of the challenges we face is that this board 3 years ago adopted some pretty bold initiatives with 5-year goals, and we can't measure those 5-year goals on some of those areas because we won't have that measurement any longer. So one of our challenges will be to take a look at our strategic initiative for student success, keep those goals in mind, and figure out the new metrics we need to use so that we're showing accountability. And that's a challenge for us with no state testing that we can use. We're looking at other means. We're looking at common assessments that we're developing that we believe will be aligned to the SBAC. But that will be something we'll be bringing back to the board. It looks as if the LCAP, I use all these acronyms, but the Local Control Accountability Plan, which will be expected of all school districts to come up with, will be the answer to part of that because it has metrics built into it. And so we'll be looking at the LCAP to see how we're supposed to be writing it. That does not go into effect until October of 2014, so that's a year away also.
It was very informative on Common Core, and I also went to a link where I could see view some videos of those in support of Common Core standards and those who have some serious questions about it. But anyway, I wanted to say that was informative, and I appreciate it, and I'm glad that there was both the pro and con links.
Very good.
Any other questions? Anybody in the public want to speak to this item? Seeing no one, we'll bring it back to the board. I noticed that we don't have minutes to approve on the agenda. Okay. So next week we'll agendize a whole bunch of them. We'll get them done. Okay. Excellent. Next we'll move on to a public hearing on the determination of sufficient textbooks and instructional materials, item number 6.01. Ms. Shields.
Good evening. As you're aware, the Ed Code requires the governing board to determine that each student has sufficient textbooks aligned to content standards in English language arts, including ELD, mathematics, science, social studies, as well as lab science equipment, foreign language, and health if they happen to be enrolled in those classes. Tonight's board item provides you with an update of where we are. You can see on the front side of as far as insufficiency, and if you turn to the back side, it lets you know what we've ordered to take care of that. Tonight is just a public hearing, and we'll be back in a couple weeks.
Let's see.
Can I ask questions?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Just a point of clarification. Yeah. So the students who are without textbooks, the 1 to 2% that are without, how do they cope? How are they provided with the materials they need?
Well, by October 15th, they will all have textbooks. Uh-huh. In the meantime, classes are up and starting. Schools are developing their communities. They may or may not be using that textbook. They might be using other resources. In the meantime, you might have the possibility of students sharing a textbook if it's so needed until these have been recovered, but we are quickly have ordered what we need to make sure that we have them for our kids before we come to our next board meeting.
So arrangements are being made in the individual classrooms for the students who are
Absolutely.
Without during this period of time. Yeah, perfect. Thank you.
Jim. And the fact that we do come up short sometimes on textbook is not an unusual event. It's, I think, almost yearly we run into something where we find a need for textbooks. Is that correct?
This is my third year in this process, and all three of those years we've been required to buy some new textbooks or buy some new used textbooks to take the place of worn out, lost, stolen, maybe not stolen, but worn out or lost textbooks, as well as bumps in enrollment. And if you look at the sheet tonight, you can see we had a little bump in fifth grade that required us to purchase some more textbooks.
And just so I'm clear and others who might be interested, this is independent of new adoptions, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. That's a whole different system.
That'll be coming as the, you know, Common Core obviously has been approved. The textbook companies are busy writing and redoing textbooks.
Yeah, so for this item, we have three kind of bullets up on the screen for you to kind of, and I'm going to touch base on each one of those as we go through. But as you know, at the end of the last school year, the board took a visit. We visited Napomo High School. We visited Aurora Grande High School, looked at the renovation projects as well as new construction. We went to the new digital high school. And the board was given the opportunity to kind of look at those sites and kind of see what renovated facilities look like, new construction, new types of classrooms, and those types of things. The board also got the opportunity to go to both Morro Bay High School as well as San Luis High School and see those campuses and what the needs were, what the facilities looked like, and basically got walked through each of those by both of the respective principals to talk about. And so based on those site visits as well as discussions with the board decided as one of their goals, that one of your goals this year was to go forward with the facilities master plan as well as do a thorough needs assessment for our school sites. And just so that the board knows, our last facility master plan, really a total update of the facility master plan was last done in 1987. So it's a long time coming in terms of us coming forward today and asking to do a study such as this. So the facility master plan and ed specs, and ed specs is kind of like a need assessment. Just so that you know, that's basically what the ed specifications aspect of the facility master plan goes through. And they go hand in hand. And so not only do we need to look at the areas that need renovation, we also need to look at basically any new construction or anything that we do to our school sites, how do they tie into teaching and our vision for the future, right? And so it's not just do we need to fix the roofs, do we need to fix the plumbing, do we need new bathrooms? It's also what are our schools going to look like? How are our teachers going to teach in the future? And really talking to them, getting insights, talking to kids, to parents, and getting those needs together. And so the facility master plan should include all of our school sites as well as, I would mention, our unused school sites and our rented facilities. So as I walked through with Jeff Guy, and we went to Old Pacheco, and we went to Morro El, and we went to Sunnyside Schools, there are still, even though we're renting those facilities now, there are still needs at those school sites and things that we may want to do even to make them better rental properties possibly, or should they ever become schools again. So we would want to definitely include those in that facility master plan study. Again, the process involves all stakeholders, and the input for the use of our facilities and future needs all come together in developing that plan. The plan also will take a look at what state averages look like. So what is the number of classroom space? What does office space look like? Gym space, bathroom, restroom space. So it also compares kind of our schools to those state averages. So that's all part of really a true, well-done facility master plan needs assessment. The next aspect of that is a demographics enrollment projection. And so I don't know if you've noticed, even today's paper, right, there's articles in the Tribune that are saying things like city council could pave the way for 142 new homes in San Luis Obispo, or recently there was an article about a building boom in San Luis and talked about these huge home developments that are coming into our city. All of our sites, all of those questions that the board is going to have, we really need to have a better handle of what our enrollment, what our future growth looks like. And so those are key aspects, I think, with that demographic study, as well as and normally along those lines, when somebody does a demographic study, they also do a developer fee justification study. So those are kind of closely tied together. So we would want to do that. Now, these are separate things. So the facility master plan, Ed Specs, is a different plan. And then the demographic enrollment study is almost a different group that would do that as well. And so lastly, the third kind of rung or bullet, and this goes along with our Prop 39. So Prop 39 is passed. We're going to be receiving some energy efficiency monies. And so there are a lot of groups out there right now that are going around doing energy audits for districts. We've been approached by a couple already. And so those are things that happen at no cost. So from Chevron and different groups, that they're willing to come in and actually do the audit for you, tell you what things you can work on, and then they give you the audit in hopes that you would use them in the future. But for the board to know, should we move in that direction and have somebody do an energy audit, any work that we would do after that would be something that we would do an RFP on, a request for proposal. So we'll, you know, kind of the same process that we're going to use for our facility master plan at Specs, as well as our demographic enrollment study, we would do the same thing should we, after the no-cost energy audit happened, you know, before we did any work, we would do the same. So those are kind of key aspects, and really they all kind of come together, right? I mean, in terms of they're all interrelated. So whatever we're going to do in terms of renovations at schools or at the high schools or anything that the board chooses to do, they all really need to kind of combine with the demographic enrollment study as well as a true energy audit. Now, what I will tell you in talking to Rick Manderscheid and Jeff Guy, it's not like we haven't done any energy efficiency. So I believe the last time was 2005. We actually had go through. They've done a lot of modernization in terms of our lighting at our school sites and those types of things. So this would be above and beyond those changes that we've already made. And so I think for the board's sake, you know, in terms of proper planning and having a clear picture for the future, I think I am requesting that the board allow the district to go out to do an RFP process, a request for proposals, one for both a facility master plan at spec, and then another RFP for our demographic developer fee justification study. So two different things. And then I will continue to work with the energy efficiency company, you know, because we could do multiple audits to see what the different plans look like, to see what people come up with in terms of what we need to work on the energy efficiency side, and that doesn't cost the district any money.
So what are we being asked to do this evening?
So basically I'm asking for approval for us to move forward so that we can go out and do a request for proposal. So hopefully a pretty quick turnaround, because I think this is really critical for the board in terms of making decisions. And so we'll do that for both. So a request for proposal for the facility master plan at spec.
Okay.
And then another request for proposal for the demographic enrollment. Yeah, so they've actually, the groups that I've come in and talked about, you know, they're more than willing to kind of look at our current solar plant, you know, agreement that we have currently in place and how that works, as well as the key with the energy audit, to be honest with you, is there are a lot of grant funds out there. There's a lot of matching monies that are available. And so by going through those companies, they basically help you get in line in terms of looking for different matching funds. And actually, today, the Prop 39 guidelines actually came out through the state. And so it'll be interesting to kind of get updated on now moving forward with the Prop 39. But we have to actually develop a plan for how we're going to use those monies prior to us being able to expend them.
Okay. Let me go to the public real quick first, if there are any members of the public would like to address this item. Okay, seeing no one. Marilyn?
Thank you. Mr. Pinkerton, when you say developer fee justification study, I know we receive developer fees, but I don't understand the fees in the context of a justification study. Could you just explain what that means?
So basically, the amount that we charge for developers to develop properties or for somebody to build a home, there's an amount that they pay. And so what the study will do is they'll look at that amount. When was the last time it changed? Should it be increased? Should it not be increased? And so that's part of what they'll do is go through that process and look and see whether or not it's justified where it's at or should it be increased. And that, again, that's going to tie into all that demographic information and growth and where we're seeing things happening in the community.
But we don't develop – it's not up to us to
we set our rates.
Developer fees.
We do set our rates.
We do set them ourselves.
To a maximum amount.
Yeah. The state.
Okay. I never even thought to ask how they were set or established.
So that would be something that would have to, once the justification fee happens and they tell us, that would be something that would come to the board and would be a decision that you would have to make.
Okay. And then on a sort of a related but unrelated topic, I've been asked several times how much savings we realize from our solar projects. And I know that information has been provided, but I'm at a loss. So could you provide that to me at some point in the future?
The whole file is actually on my desk right now. And it's something that I actually want to dive into and
kind of
get a better handle on what
it
means.
I don't know if other board members get that question, but
it's a great question.
Several times. So when you know, if you could pass it on, and
we'll
so I'll be able to share it with the public. Okay, thank you.
You okay with Friday notes on that, Marilyn?
Oh, sure.
Okay.
When we go out and do this facilities master plan, it's almost dovetailing on Common Core standards and a lot of other changes that are going on. One that comes to mind is technology. Mm-hmm. So the classroom of today, pretty much the standards, 900 square feet, and a desk for every kid and whatever. So will we be looking at sort of trying to go a little bit towards the future and maybe trying to encompass some of what's going on now?
Yeah, so there's different products out there in terms of bonds and facilities. And actually, Mr. Unger actually shared one today that they're doing Pacific Grove in terms of a technology bond system. Means tablets, what books are we going to have? Are they going to be on tablets? That committee is going to begin very soon. In fact, we have a meeting tomorrow to talk about it. From there, that's really going to tie right into our LCAP, which is kind of our budget. What is our budget plan? How are we going to do that? Because the $1.4 million isn't going to be enough. So instruction materials money, we have $1.8 million instruction materials money. Tie in what other budget revenues, whatever sources are we going to do. But we really need to have a long-range plan for how we're going to get to that point and what are we going to do with our students. And so all of that will be part of the facility master plan and really the ed spec part.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I thank you, Mark, for bringing that up and Ryan for thinking about that as well, because I think this is the time when we're looking at the LCFF and the LCAP. We're really going to be looking at that intersection of accountability in our facilities. And I don't think we've ever had to do that before. And when I think about the plan we're going to have to come up with, this is one more thing that I think will be able to help lead us down that road toward education accountability for kids. I think another thing that's real important when we look at the demographics, and we talked, I don't know how much we've talked about this, but when we looked at the old demographic studies, they can affect school boundaries. And that's something I think we're going to have to look at as in addition to school facilities, whether our current school boundaries are working. So this will help us with that. And then finally, as your tech committee looks at, the Common Core committee looks at things, I would just ask you to continue to look at the Los Angeles Unified experience with their tablets, because I think they've had some unintended consequences there.
You know, I think the just one more thing in terms of the demographic study, too. I really feel like once we get that information, we really need to talk to the city. So we really need to go in front of the city, and as they're planning these developments, as they're moving out and adding more homes, that they really think about putting school sites in those areas. And so that is really something that, you know, in the past, a long time ago, neighborhoods were built around schools. And so that whole mindset has changed. And so they really, hopefully the city, is really considering having school sites around these huge developments that have been planned in the neighborhoods. So that'll be something that I really look forward to the demographic information and sharing that with the city council.
As we go forward with thinking about this, I think that also, I mean, I'm sure this goes without saying, but thinking in terms of our large community and then drilling down to the details of the initiatives, and that they, if we decide to do this, that whoever undertakes the large task of completing this for us, of performing the study, is very aware of what our initiatives are.
Yeah. Since this is an action item, I'd like to move this item. And do you want it separately, or do you?
Yeah,
want it
just to, I really want them to be two different RFP processes.
I'll move that we develop an RFP for the facility master plan and ed specs component.
Just all types of community groups came out and were part of it.
So we will monitor though the elementary input for, you know, ice cream machines and pizza.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
It's all priorities.
Yeah, I just had one little quick comment here. It's interesting to me that last night several of us were able to attend the Classified Employees of the Year dinner, and I was seated at a table with Guy Crabb and his wife Janet, who's a fourth grade teacher at Teach School. And he was explaining to me that his students are involved in a project of creating the desk of the future, designing and creating the desk of the future. And it's interesting that they're rolling along that track. They're really having a good time trying to decide what that desk is going to need, what kind of technology, screens and this, and could desks be connected to one another so that student thoughts could be, you know, they're fourth graders, but they're really thinking outside the box on the desk of the future. And so as we roll down this path ourselves, I just wanted to kind of give him a little kudo on that exercise that his kids are doing. And we might consider consulting his class before making any decisions.
I always think I need to.
Yeah, Chris, we have to go.
No, we have a motion in a second.
Yeah, but I thought I did. We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Questenberry, to approve the RFP for the facility study. Any board comment and discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. And now we'll entertain a motion on the RFP for the demographic study. Marilyn?
I'll move approval of going for RFP, doing an RFP for a demographic and enrollment study.
I'll second that.
We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mrs. Sheffer. Any further board comment or discussion? Seeing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Thank you, Mr. Pinkerton.
Thank you.
We will move on to...
I'd like to make a motion.
Oh.
For the energy audit,
we're not. They're not asking us to do that.
Okay.
It doesn't cost anything.
That's true, but I have it as a main interest. So.
Oh no, it is.
I was really hoping to make them.
Yes, it's definitely interesting.
You're denting the brown.
Are we in favor of looking at LED light bulb?
We are now going to move on. Are you handling the next item too? The Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School Memorandum of Understanding.
So yeah, it looks like Mr. Getz is here. We can hopefully put a bow on this tonight. And in front of the board is basically the only really major change from the last time Mr. Goetz and Ed Sklar, our attorney from Lozano Smith, was here, is that we kind of worked out the how are we going to deal with deferred maintenance if there was a major accident or a flood or earthquake or something that happened on the facility, how would we deal with that? And so so that language was added and vetted through our attorneys, and basically the whole thing dramatic happened like that, we would actually look to try to house them somewhere else and then sit down with Bellevue Santa Fe and try to work out a plan to where we could refurbish it and get the school back running. So that was really the only major difference from the last time we were here.
You mean the last time you were here discussing the proposed
MOU? Yes.
Okay, because the proposed MOU has significant changes in it, even though the changes you're talking about this evening are not as, well, they're substantial. But I think it's, well, first let me see if anybody from the public wants to address this. Okay, seeing no one, we'll come back to the board. But there's a couple of issues that I had some concerns about. First of all, it's a dense read, a very dense read. But as I understand it, Bellevue Santa Fe is moving to a direct funding formula because they're going to be their own LEA.
Yes.
Okay. And do we know enough about the local, where's my pamphlet?
Control funding formula.
FCFF, thank you. To know that this is going to be viable in the future for the kids at Bellevue Santa Fe in that school and also okay with the district as well.
So it's very close in terms of amounts of what they're currently receiving versus what they're going to receive. So it's more, but currently the district is giving them services, custodial, grounds, paying for the copier, other things. So we're doing that. So basically what we're doing is we're taking those funds through the LCFF, giving them to the charter school and giving them really the local control over how they're going to deal with those funds. And so remember the key tie-in too was the fact that for the district, there was a concern about the special education aspect of the charter school, if they're allowing students outside of our district boundaries. So that was a key aspect, and I believe why Mr. Miller brought this up and kind of started the discussions in the first place with Bellevue. And so, you know, will that LCFF continue to rise to an extent where it's a lot more than now for the district and become an issue? Possibly. But again, this is an agreement that goes through 2018. So we'll be able to re-examine this entire document in 2018 and really determine where we're at. Is it a positive thing? Do we continue to move forward? And, you know, what's in terms of what's the district's best interest at that time?
And as to the special education paragraphs, it's my understanding that through the 2013-2014 school year, it's going to basically remain unchanged.
Yes.
The charter school will be in the, help me, Chris, the SELPA. And the SELPA the way it is now.
That's represented by us.
As represented by San Luis Coastal Unified School District, like it has been in the past up to this point.
And then in the outlying years, the idea is for Bellevue Santa Fe to become its own LEA. And
they're going to apply to try to do that.
And then if that's successful, then they will join the SELPA on their own.
Yes. Should that not happen, we will be meeting again next year.
Okay. And assuming it does happen that way, then they would provide their own special ed services in areas where it would be more advantageous to them.
District, we don't have flood or earthquake insurance for that property even now. We never have.
I would not expect earthquake insurance necessarily, but flood insurance.
Yeah, we don't have flood insurance on that on that school site. That's not something that we've had leading up to this point. Just so you, I mean, as I investigated this, I found this out. So it's something that we would actually go out and purchase as a separate policy outside of our normal school facilities insurance that we have. But I am looking into it for their sake, for our sake, because truly it is our facility. So they are renting out our facility. So it is still up to us to make sure that that facility is maintained, that it's up to code, that all of those things are, you know, are tied in, and that it's a safe place for kids to go to school. So we do have our interest in terms of deferred maintenance and making sure the facility is up to date.
Okay. Thank you.
And by renting out our facilities, they are renting them out for a dollar a year?
Yes.
Okay. Let's see. Any other questions, Chris?
Yeah, not particularly germane to Bellevue Santa Fe, but since I think the only other school, when I think about it, that could be prone to flooding is Morro Bay High School. Could you check into it for Morro Bay High School, too?
I will do that.
Thank you very much.
You got it.
Let's see. Okay, so you're looking for a motion for approval of the MOU as it is currently stands?
Yes.
Okay. Board members feel comfortable moving forward with this?
Yes. I would like to move approval of this motion 7.02, I believe it is, the MOU with Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School.
Okay. I'll second. So, motion by Mrs. Eisendrath-Rogers and second by the chair to approve the memorandum of understanding between the school district and Bellevue Santa Fe Charter School. Okay. Comments, discussions?
Well, I just don't want to let the moment pass without saying how much I appreciate the good faith negotiations that took place between Mr. Goetz and Mr. Pinkerton representing the district, and I'm really gratified that we've come to a good resolution here and an MOU.
Good.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We definitely have a good relationship working, I think, and positive, so it's good.
Your light's still on. Did you want to?
No, I'm sorry. Okay. That was the light.
Okay. All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes 7-0. Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Many more years of success. Okay. Oops, where'd I go? Approval of to pay a board member salary for permissible absence. A questionable agenda item at best. So he was in the nation's capital doing his best for education. So before it ceased to function. Anyway, is there any member of the public that would like to address this item? Okay. All right. In that case,
I'll move approval.
Oh, go, Marilyn. Yeah.
Of item 7.03.
All right. We have a motion by Mrs. Roger and a second by Mr. Buckman.
I'm going to kind of repeat some comments I made in front of San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce this last week, and I apologize for anyone who was there. I think Mrs. Sheffer was there, and but I think I can make it just slightly longer. Yeah, slightly longer than I did there, because of course when you speak at the chamber, they give you 5 minutes and kick you in the shin if you go 15 seconds over. So I'm keeping my distance. The latest and greatest in education reform, of course, is called the Common Core. And what is it? It's really a reaction to the Obama administration's Race to the Top movement to equalize education across the country, which is a reaction to the Bush-era No Child Left Behind Act, which sought accountability for teachers in schools, which was a reaction to the emphasis on academic freedom for teachers, which was a reaction to some isolated successes of the charter school movement and the push for vouchers, which was a reaction to the report Why Johnny Can't Read, which was a reaction to the whole language movement, which was a reaction to the back to basics movement, which was a reaction to the open classroom concept, which was a reaction to the Vietnam era's freedom and democracy in education movement, which was a reaction to Nixon's Title IX passage, which gave equal opportunities to females in our schools, which was an offshoot of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which was a reaction to the need for desegregation in schools, which was a reaction to the fact that minority students were tragically behind, especially in math and science, which was a reaction to the Federal Defense Education Act, which was a reaction to the Soviets putting men and monkeys in space ahead of us. So you can blame the Common Core on the Russians. I'm very supportive of this new movement, and And you will find me not using the term personally Common Core very often, because if it hasn't already, and I think it has, it's becoming more and more politicized in our public discourse. And my fear is that most people are going to learn everything they need to know about Common Core from Rachel Maddow or Rush Limbaugh or, you know, Stephen Colbert or something, and really never understand it. The Common Core really just refers to national standards in language arts and literacy and mathematics. And what is a standard? A standard is simply the things we expect students to know and be able to do at certain points as they progress through our school system. So I want to give you a few things that I think are important about these new educational standards, these national standards, see if I got that. So first of all, it's important. This is the first time in our nation's history that we have national standards, which is kind of an amazing thing to think about. What's significant about that is they are national standards, but they emanated from the states. They are not a top-down directive. So they actually came from the Council of Governors. They were actually bipartisan in their support. They emanated from the states, different states getting together and saying, you know, most countries in the world have national standards, and they seem to be outpacing us, so why don't we get on board? We live in a mobile society. In the state of California, for example, more than half of the people were not born here. And throughout our state, we have a year and a half ago, and there were things I was tremendously impressed with there and others that I hope never get brought over to the United States. But we can't argue the fact that in certain areas, mathematics being chief among them, that we've been outpaced by a lot of countries. And part of that reason is because that we have been stressing discrete knowledge and breadth of knowledge over depth. And so what these educational national standards really get to is the fact that, you know, knowledge is cheap. Knowledge is highly accessible. Knowledge is on our cell phones. But the application of that knowledge and the discernment of that knowledge and the ability to skillfully use it to speak, to write, to communicate, to solve problems is what we should be emphasizing. Which leads to another point, which is that these standards are about college and workforce readiness. And that's significant because in the history of American education, the goal of K-12 education has been a high school diploma and hopefully getting some kids into college or teaching them some career skills. But the goals really of these standards is college readiness and or workplace readiness. In 1890, 7% of our students in our country went to high school. As late as 1940, which isn't that long ago, we only had 3/4 of the country actually going to high school. And at that point in 1942, the graduation rate was 49%. So it makes sense that we had high school diploma as a goal. But the goal of these common standards now is not high school diploma. That's something that should happen. They really are about college and workplace readiness. And so these standards, if they're better standards, should lead to better assessment. So I talked about AB 484 a bit ago. What's significant about, I think, the assessment system is not only that we're getting away from kind of that discrete knowledge, multiple choice types of testing, although we will still have some of that, and that will be part of this, but that it's based on computer assessments, kind of a 21st century concept, and that the results for these assessments are expected to be back in teachers' hands between 24 and 48 hours of taking the test. That's pretty significant. So right now, when we have state testing, we wait till the school year is over to see the results of those tests. This new system, if it works, and we'll be field testing it this year, will give pretty instantaneous results for the entire school district so we can really target what we need to be working on with instruction. And my last point would be that the standards really aren't a curriculum. So while I think it's going to be better for students, it's also going to be better for teachers. It's really interesting, as I talk to teachers, it's our most veteran teachers that seem to be the most excited about the Common Core, because what they're saying is, finally, I'm getting to kind of recreate that creativity and artistry of being a teacher instead of just teaching to a test. That these Common Core standards, these national standards, really are developing pedagogy over curriculum. And that's a significant thing. I think of in terms of some of our best teachers are people who are music teachers or who are coaches, because they understand that they have to both have a challenging curriculum, also creativity and artistry back in the teaching force. So I am a history teacher, and I was at one time, and so I do believe Common Core will go away, like every other reform, someday. I hope it doesn't go away too soon. I also think, though, that if we do this right, if we really buy into this, which 45 states have bought into it, that if we do it right, it'll actually kind of reinvigorate what is great about this country, because it should kind of bring back a spirit of entrepreneurship. It should bring back a spirit of Yankee ingenuity. The standards, because they're national, because they're kind of being bought into by everybody, they will commit ourselves to all students, regardless of their socioeconomic status or where they come from. But I, for one, am not satisfied with our country, whatever the measure may be, being second or third or 15th in any of those measures. And so if we do it right, we can get back to being number one in most areas. So I'm excited about the Common Core, and I hope you are too. And thank you as a board for supporting it. And I'm available for questions if you have any.
Okay. Does anybody from the public wish to speak to this item? Okay. Seeing no one, bring up to the board any questions or discussions for Mr. Robinette? Okay, thank you, Rick. And I think, did he get in under the 5 minutes?
Oh, no.
All right.
No.
Kick him.
It was short.
Thank you. We'll move on to the action consent agenda. Please let me know if you want an item pulled. Approval of certificated classified personnel items. Approval to teach a class outside of credential authorization. Disposition of surplus property. Acceptance of donations. Approval of purchase orders. Approval of warrants and payroll. Is that the last one? Oh, good. Okay. I'll entertain a motion for items 8.01 through 8.06.
I'll move approval of items 8.01 to 8.06.
I'll second that motion.
Okay. We have a motion by Mr. Unger, second by Mr. Questenberry. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes 7-0. Action on items...
Advanced agenda,
yeah. Reports by board members. Go, Marilyn. Oh, did you have a report? Oh, that's what I said, go. Go.
It actually was a thought that just popped into my head and came out my mouth. I have one. I had the opportunity to attend a Common Core math demonstration workshop night last week at Baywood School, and it was awesome. I opted out of math in 7th or 8th grade myself, and I could never foresee a time that I would be excited about mathematics, but this presentation was just so fabulous that I was excited for maybe 2 days afterwards. It was arranged by Mrs. Amy Shields, and there were two presenters. One was Barb Blonky, and then Mr. Wong, I want to say Ed, but I'm not sure. So I'll call basic instruction. We'll be getting that in a way that they can understand and expand upon. And kids who need acceleration, I could see the opportunities were there for them to really be stretched in what was presented. If you are looking for two different ways to arrive at the same answer, I guess you would say, there may be 10 different ways to do it, and kids who want to move farther will be seeking those additional ways. And it was just so clear to me in a way that I had not been clear previously about what Common Core math could look like. It was really a terrific presentation, and I think they'll be doing it again in the spring. I don't know where, and I would encourage anyone else, any of my colleagues that is able to attend, to do so, because it just really makes you feel good about where we're headed in math. And I thank Mrs. Shields for her efforts.
Thank you. I just want to add, I just want to make a connect for you that
These are the same two people that have been providing our professional development for our preschool through sixth grade teachers for the last 2.5 years. So I'm glad you liked it.
Let us know when the spring one is scheduled. Thanks. Okay, Ellen?
I would, as Rick Robinette pointed out, I was fortunate enough to attend his presentation at the Chamber Breakfast last weekend, and found it very exciting that a room full, I mean hundreds of people attend these events every month. You could have heard a pin drop as he was speaking, and that is not often the case. I don't know whether they were stunned to be hearing a presentation on education, but I think they were really interested. I love seeing the community, the business community, other people who are attending, paying close attention to what is happening with education in San Luis Coastal School District and the country and our state, but to pay such close and thoughtful attention to the presentation. And I know that some of it had to do with the manner in which he presented, but also that it was gratifying to see the interest in our K-12 students so much at Chamber events is about Cuesta and Cal Poly, which of course are very important educational components to our community, but we don't spend a lot of time talking about K-12 and all those schools that are right where everyone goes home at night and lives. And it was wonderful to have Rick make that presentation to about changes going on, and the community support and interest was also very gratifying.
Sure, and I just wanted to just review for everybody really quickly a little travel log. You know, I went to Washington, D.C. the last meeting, and for those of you who were watching on TV, that's why I missed the meeting. There were several things we talked about, but I just wanted to share the most important ones. The main issue we talked about was special education funding. The federal government promised 40% contribution for special education when IDEA was passed in 1975. Right now, the feds kick in about 11.5%. The state kicks in about 47%. Is down here when the authorization is about here. What we're afraid is going to happen is that under the budgets that have been proposed, the authorizations will fall to the current appropriations level minus 5% for the sequestration. Yeah, it's jaw-dropping. It's pretty amazing. Other things we talked about were just the importance in our school districts would be so proud of what we're doing, the importance of early childhood education, and especially for special education kids, just intervening early, trying to get rid of reduplicative paperwork, and addressing the parent opt-out. Because right now in California, any parent could opt their kids out of the testing, which puts their schools even in whether we do testing or not, which puts their schools in jeopardy. And yet California parents have absolutely the right to withdraw their kids from the testing. So we talked about that too. Just some important things to talk about. I know the federal government is now semi-closed. It's going to have a terrible effect on our local communities, especially Head Start. I think in San Luis Obispo County, one of the places that I think we don't really see it, but I think we will, are the civilian employees who work for the military, because those are people that are not going to be working. So Camp San Luis, Fort Hunter Leggett, Vandenberg, all those places, I think there's going to be some tremendous economic hurt that will trickle down into our communities. I think for our poor communities, it's really going to be unfortunate, because education, especially when we think about the sequestration, education is so important to those communities, and the fact that in many communities, schools are the major employer in their communities. And as we see our funding cut in our local communities, we're going to see people go on unemployment. We're going to see people getting even hungrier. And by the way, and I'm getting real political now, $40 billion in cuts in food stamps, which we know is going to hurt kids in this community and throughout this county. So it was an interesting trip. I was really fortunate to be able to go. I went with a bunch of good people. We saw
lots and lots of folks. Did we change any minds? I don't know. Did we remind people about what local education is all about and what special ed is all about? I think we did. So it was great. Thanks for letting me go.
Okay, that's going to be tough.
I should. When I get on the roll.
I did. I don't think I have a single number in here. I did want to follow up on something that Ellen said. I was able to attend a luncheon where there were chamber folks with Bill Monning. And it was probably one of the few times that I've been with the chamber where several of the questions directly had to do with LCFF and Common Core, and that was exciting. So I'm from a different perspective, a different meeting, I'm seeing the same thing. That was really exciting. The other thing I'd like to do is, as board members, we often get a voluminous amount of email, and amongst that is the newsletters from each of the school sites. And I am
along with Catherine and Jim and Ellen, and I were able to tour the district offices with Sally Ames, the head of adult ed, on Mark. That's right. I thought I recognized it. It's the beard. Yeah, grew out more. And it was an amazing tour. Sally Ames has done incredible things with the adult education program. The offerings are perhaps even more robust than they were back when there was actually money for a lot of these things. And just her industry and excitement and connection to the people that those programs serve was very impressive. And I also learned that this facility up here is a beehive. There is more stuff going on than I ever really appreciated. So it was very educational, and I appreciate the time that everybody took to show us around. And I'm looking forward to tomorrow at Baywood, 9 o'clock. Be there if you can. Catherine, anybody? Okay. Let's be adjourned until, don't tell me, October 15th. Thank you, everybody. At Loam's, yeah.
Wow.